Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is off today. We'll start today with our week in review, and this was a week of new beginnings.
Annuncio vobis, gaudium magnum, habemus papam.
Yes, we have a pope, but is Jorge Mario Bergoglio the answer to the challenges facing the Catholic Church? Also this week, the Massachusetts Republican candidates for U.S. Senate faced off in their first debate, which featured a lot more agreement than debate.
I absolutely agree with Senator Rand and what he did.
I would absolutely go down there and I would stand up until I got an answer.
I think Senator Paul was asking legitimate questions.
It was also a week of goodbyes to Judge Richard Stern from the trial of James Whitey Bulger.
The trial must be overseen by a judge who is not connected to the most infamous period in federal law enforcement history in Boston.
And to the Boston Phoenix, which ceased publication after 47 years.
We're a vital part of the community, but we don't have enough money to remain being vital, if that makes sense.
Well, we'll dig into these stories and others, our weekly hubbub included, with two members of our Week in Review panel. Dante Ramos is the deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Hey, Dante, welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And John Carroll, BU professor of communication and the guy behind CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com. John, great to have you.
Great to be here.
So let's start with a big story this week, which was far from a local Boston story, though anytime you talk about the Catholic Church, it has a special resonance across this city. There's a new pope, Pope Francis I. He's Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina, the first non-European pope in modern times and the first member of the Jesuit order to lead the church. Many are celebrating him, including President Obama, as a champion of the poor. He's also being scrutinized by others for his relative silence during Argentina's dirty war and for his rather traditional views on women's ordination and homosexuality. Boston, of course, ground zero of the clergy sex abuse scandal. Does this pope, and Dante, let me start with you, offer some kind of an opportunity for a new beginning and healing around this issue, perhaps? What do you think?
I think there's not enough on Bergoglio's record to assess how he would handle the sex abuse issues in particular. It's funny, let me get really local on this. There was a lot of speculation before the conclave concluded that maybe Sean O'Malley would be a potential pope. And the reason that people outside of Boston were interested in him was partly because of this perception that he was very humble and interested in the plight of the poor, and also the feeling that, while not to the satisfaction of victims advocates here in Boston, that he had dealt more directly with some of the sex abuse issues than other authorities in the Vatican. And I think that with Bergoglio, you're getting one half of that equation. You're getting the kind of personal humility. But, as to whether a cleric who has been in Argentina for most of his career and, hasn't been deeply involved behind the scenes at the Vatican Curia, where there's said to be a lot of intrigue behind the scenes, it's hard to say really whether somebody coming in like that would be able to, promote more openness and transparency within the church, which is what a lot of people are looking for.
Yeah, and John, let me turn to you on that, because, of course, anytime there's a new pope, there is a lot of sort of expectation and hope, new beginning, fresh beginning, so on and so forth. What's your view of Pope Francis I?
Well, he is a traditional conservative choice for pope, I think. But in one area, he may be more aggressive than people think, and that is exactly with the Roman Curia. He has been critical of them. He has talked about the church being a closed, self-referential fortress, and he says they can't do that. They have to be outward-looking, and you have to go out among the people. And when you go out, accidents happen. But that's the price you pay, you know, and that's where the church should be at this point. So to sort of take that hidebound Vatican industrial complex and try to reform it to some degree to bring it closer to the people may be one of the things that that will turn the church around in terms of its global sort of demise.
Mm. John, we heard Dante mention Archbishop Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who was sort of talked about leading up to this process as sort of a long, the sort of dark horse candidate, long shot candidate to be Pope. Of course, he wasn't. We heard Cardinal O'Malley suggest again and again that he didn't want to be Pope, that he's glad to be coming back to Boston, that being Pope is like being in a museum. Do you buy that?
Yeah, raise your hand if you really believe Cardinal O'Malley when he says, I'm so glad I'm not the Pope. I'm skeptical, and I think that one of the things to consider is positioning. Sean O'Malley is a really, really smart media guy. He really knows what he's doing in terms of media and image. One of the things that people say the church needs is someone who can communicate much better than the previous popes have been able to. Sean O'Malley is that guy. So when you're looking at the church, and they're saying, some people are saying, look, it's not the message, it's the messenger. You know, it's not the pizza, it's the box. Sean O'Malley is someone who can go and turn images around. Pope Francis is 76 years old. I mean, they have elected another frail, elderly, white cleric. There's going to be another conclave before too long, and Sean O'Malley could be seen as positioning himself for that.
Final thought from you, Dante Ramos, on Sean O'Malley and the future of the papacy.
Well, I think John's right. One of the things that was notable about the choice of Bergoglio is that he's said to have been the also-ran the last time around, and that was thought perhaps to be a disqualifier, and the assumption that people had made as well, he'd been passed over once essentially for Cardinal Ratzinger 8 years ago, but that certainly didn't preclude him from stepping forward and being chosen this time. So, it may well be that O'Malley, if his reputation continues to grow within the church, that he would be seen as a viable candidate in the future.
Well, let's move on to this week's big development in the case against reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger. Bulger's lawyers won a major pre-trial victory when they convinced a federal appeals court to remove Judge Richard Stearns from overseeing the trial. The reason? Stearns was a senior federal prosecutor in Boston back in the 1980s when Bulger was known to be an FBI informant. Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney, argued that that fact compromised Stearns' ability to rule impartially. Here's J.W. Carney.
The trial must be overseen by a judge who is not connected to the most infamous period in federal law enforcement history in Boston.
Now, yesterday, a federal appeals court agreed with that. The Honorable David Souter wrote in his decision that it's clear that a reasonable person might question the judge's ability to preserve impartiality through the course of this prosecution. John, big news, obviously, but how significant is Stearns' departure for the overall outcome of this case, the way this trial is going to be handled?
Well, first, let me just say it's good to know that David Souter has a hobby that takes up some of his time and keeps him occupied. That's good to know.
You mean that whole judicial thing?
Exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Either that or woodworking.
I think it's a significant legal victory, but I think it's also a significant PR victory for Whitey Bulger and for Jay Carney. I think that that essentially they're trying to cast doubt on the entire criminal justice system, and I think that their goal is to convince people that this whole thing is rigged against Whitey Bulger. Now, whether that succeeds or not is sort of beside the point. But I think the switch in judges and the judge who has been assigned this case now, who is Denise Casper, is a young judge. And I don't know if that works to Carney's advantage or not. I think it might in some ways. But this is someone who is probably not going to be challenged by Carney. And I think Carney says he's not going to ask for a delay. I think that she may ask for a delay so that she can get familiar with the case.
Yeah, named today, Denise J. Casper. She's the first black woman to sit as a federal judge in Boston. We don't know too much about her at this point, except that she, like Stearns, is a former federal prosecutor who supervised the Boston U.S. Attorney's a drug unit. Dante, your thoughts on this decision this week?
In the short term, it's certainly a victory for the defense. Anything that creates, as John said, a certain level of uncertainty or chaos or, just a lack of momentum in the proceedings would seem to be a victory for Whitey Bulger. And if the trial is delayed, it's seen as a victory for Bulger. If the trial goes forward but kind of proceeds in a plotting way or gets out of control because the judge, is less familiar with what's gone on up until now, that presumably is a victory too. The one thing I would say is that it does remove, if it does end in a conviction of Bulger, it does remove a really significant issue that might cause the decision to be overturned on appeal. There was a lot of hand-wringing in Boston about whether Stern should recuse himself or not, but it's noteworthy that it was a unanimous decision by the panel. They went out of their way to say that nothing that he had done, suggested that he had made improper decisions up to this point or anything like that. Nevertheless, it wasn't really a close call for them. A unanimous decision written by a former U.S. Supreme Court justice. What else is there to say?
Yeah. Well, let's move on. Let's shift to the race for the U.S. Senate and the race to succeed John Kerry. This week, the Republican candidates debated for the first time. State Representative Dan Winslow, businessman and former Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez, and U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan agreed more than they disagreed. They talked about everything from gun control to Social Security to immigration. So here's a little clip of two of them, Dan Winslow and Gabriel Gomez, talking about Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's high-profile filibuster last week over the appointment of John Brennan to head the CIA and the whole constitutional questions raised about the administration's drone program. Let's listen.
It's your mind over bladder at that point. I would absolutely go down there and I would stand up until I got an answer about these issues, about the violation of civil liberties.
I absolutely agree with Senator Rand and what he did. Now, in terms of whether I would go down there and filibuster for 13 hours, look, I used to be a SEAL. I think I could go for a few days.
So that was Gabriel Gomez. Before that was Dan Winslow. Dante Ramos, there was a lot more disagreement than debate the other night. What did you take away from this first encounter among the Republicans?
Well, it's, as you say, there's more of an agreement than a disagreement, and it's more interesting, I think, the atmospherics of it. The fact that Dan Winslow was making bladder jokes about about the filibuster. One of the interesting and good things about Republican politics in Massachusetts is that there aren't that many people involved in it, and there's a very short path from obscurity to having a really high profile in the state. And as a result, there's a little bit of an improvisational quality, if you want to call that, among some of the people who are running for office. And by all accounts, Gomez, looked really, really nervous and was wringing his hands and so forth. And I think even in that clip, you heard a little bit of kind of wavering in his voice. Winslow, who, is known around the legislature as being somebody who's brimming with ideas and has a lot to kind of an eclectic message, hasn't been able to craft that crisp a message necessarily up to this point. So, these are candidates who are still in development. And I think you saw that the other night.
Yeah. What do you think, John?
Well, the bladder test is actually the first tiebreaker in case nobody shows up to vote for any of these guys in the special primary. I think when you have the factory-installed GOP policy positions, then it becomes very much an issue of personality and comfort level that the voters have. And I think that the person who seemed to come out best from this debate was Winslow, because he seemed to have the best overall command of the issues. Gomez, reportedly, his hands were shaking. He was very nervous. He's really doing himself a disservice, I think, by not going out and doing interviews and getting comfortable with sort of being a public figure in terms of dealing with the issues and dealing with the media. Michael Sullivan, also, according to reports, seemed to be a little narrower in his grasp of the issues than Winslow. So I think that that essentially the impression that people get from these three candidates is going to be a big factor in terms of how they decide.
Well, there's going to be more opportunities. State Representative Dan Winslow has called for 9 debates between now and the primary on April 30th. That would certainly give voters ample time to assess these candidates. Michael Sullivan says that's overkill and only wants 4 debates. Still, there'll be plenty more opportunities for folks to sort of figure out who these guys are.
Can I just throw one more thing in?
Absolutely.
This letter came out that Gomez had written to Governor Patrick. Patrick, saying, why don't you appoint me as the fill-in for John Kerry until the special election, because I will go down and I'll reinforce and vote for all of Obama's issues. That really is going to hurt him with the party faithful, and the party faithful are the ones who are going to turn out for this election. So I think that has not been good for him, and his whole idea vacillating between I supported Obama in 2008, but I voted for John McCain. That's going to lead him into a number of difficult positions and difficult explanations.
Yeah, that's going to be a complicated one because, as you said in the letter, he said he supported President Obama's positions on at least a couple of issues. But in Tuesday's debate, he said he opposes both the assault weapons ban and amnesty for undocumented immigrants. So needs to sort those positions out. Let's move on to big news and about the sad end of what has been part of Boston's media landscape for almost a half a century. The Boston Phoenix, the alternative newspaper that's covered news, politics, culture, and the arts for the past 47 years, shutting down. 6 months ago, the paper tried to reinvent itself as a weekly glossy in an effort to attract more national advertisers. It didn't work. So yesterday, executive editor Peter Kadzis told us that the Phoenix is done.
We made the very difficult decision then, rather than strip down to being a shadow of our former self, publishing something that wouldn't in fact be the Boston Phoenix, we decided to pull the plug.
I got to say, I'm really sad about this. I mean, my sort of college years go back to this part of the world. The Phoenix has been sort of part of the landscape. John, your blog is called "It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town." Is it still it's still a two daily town, right? But we've got one less weekly.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Boston's losing an important part of its history and a significant force in journalism for many, many years, mm-hmm. in terms of the people that the Phoenix turned out and sent off into the journalism world. And there are terrific people still writing there now. Lloyd Schwartz on music, David Bernstein on politics. But the Phoenix wasn't quite at the end an alternative weekly. The Phoenix was very much a mainstream publication, and it really had to be, because once all the head shops closed down, you had to provide an environment for advertisers that was basically comfortable for them, that was mainstream for them, and that's who they needed, and that's in the end who they didn't have. One other thing, the whole combination of the Phoenix and Stuff magazine into this slick, glossy magazine, I think when you take two faltering publications and you sort of smush them together, that's not really a solution for the most part. That's really a death rattle.
Well, Dante, it certainly is sort of the latest sign of this changing and increasingly uncertain sort of media world. What's your response to the end of the Boston Phoenix?
Well, it's as sad as both of yours. I too first started reading it as a student, and when I kind of arrived in town, it represented a very particular idea of Boston as this center for the arts, and there was this alternative culture and nightlife that was going on, and you had the impression from reading the Phoenix that there were students and grad students and other 20-somethings who were plotting in coffee houses and other sort of alternative spaces against this lumbering political system that the paper portrayed so well, and it was hard to get over how well written it was and how much there was to it. But, as you've both alluded to, the it's part of this category called alternative news weeklies, mm-hmm. and I think that the meaning of the word alternative has kind of changed over time in a way. I think that they were known for a couple of different things. One was the magazine-like articles about problems of local significance. And then the other is the arts and culture coverage. And I think, as with a lot of the rest of the media environment, you can get a lot of the music and the arts coverage elsewhere. If you're somebody who is new to town and is interested in music, you might be looking at kind of national websites like Pitchfork or something like that, rather than turning to a local source like the Phoenix. And similarly, there's a sense that a lot of the people who are in the Phoenix audience, people who are younger, less attached to Boston, are almost necessarily going to be less interested in local news over time.
Well, changing times, sad story. We're going to end this segment on that note. Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe, thanks so much. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. You too.
And John Carroll, Communications Professor at BU and the blogger behind CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town.com. And we are happy that there are still two dailies in this town. John Carroll, have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, Anthony.
Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, the struggle to save the pushcart vendors in downtown Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.